This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Raymond Strother, the well-known political consultant. He'll be pinch-hitting for Jake Tapper, who is a last-minute scrapping interview today. So we'll talk with Raymond Strother about what's going on in Washington and in Baton Rouge. And, of course, there's much to discuss. This week was an inaugural week, and yesterday the Secretary of Defense announced that women will be allowed to participate in combat roles. That's one of the topics for Raymond Strother. Also, Dr. Jack Refuse, former White House energy advisor, current principal of his own organization on energy policy in these times, and author Wiley Cash. His book is A Land More Kind Than Home. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. We begin with Ray Strother, the well-versed political consultant who's been in the game for a few years, about 40 or so, and he is with us to talk about an eventful week as President Obama took the oath of office to begin his second term as U.S. President, the first person to get 51% or more in two straight presidential elections since Dwight David Eisenhower, Barack Hussein Obama. Barack Obama's done something Ronald Reagan didn't do, Bill Clinton didn't do. How about that? Many thought he would lose the election. I think Fox News was calling the election for Mitt Romney on Election Day. Raymond Strother, what happened?
I was a little queasy about it myself. I thought Obama would win, but I thought it'd be closer than it was. It was actually quite a victory. What happened was there was a Republican delusion in that they had two or three pollsters they really believed in, and the pollsters got it completely wrong. And I know why they got it wrong. I can see how they got it wrong. They had the wrong models. In other words, you have to have models when you poll. You have to make some assumptions, and they made false assumptions about the voter turnout. But it was a surprise to me that night, although, as I said, I expected the president to pull it out narrowly.
Well, it's been an eventful week already. As we talked earlier, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is lifting the military's official ban on women in combat. It'll open up hundreds of thousands of additional frontline jobs. This is something that overturns a 1994 Pentagon rule, and remember Bill Clinton was president then, that restricts women from artillery, armor, infantry, and other such combat roles. What do you think of this development?
Well, there's been advancement for women since Seneca Falls before the Civil War, and this is just the next move. It's the right thing to do. That isn't all that happened. You had some more women elected to the U.S. Senate, more women elected to the U.S. House, and it's just a natural progression of women's rights, I think, in society, that they be given an equal role. And well, according to the military chiefs, I listened this morning to a former Joint Chief of Staff, and he said it was a good thing. So who can I argue with the military?
The other issue that has been percolating now for over a month since the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, is the issue of gun rights, and the president is out in front on this issue. He mentioned it in his inaugural address. Today, a headline in the New York Times front page, Democrats and Senate confront doubts at home on gun laws. How challenging will it be for Democratic members of the U.S. Senate from places like West Virginia and Louisiana to advocate any kind of change in gun laws?
In Montana also, where I'm living right now.
That is true.
Impossible. There'll be no major assault weapon ban. There'll be some incremental changes, perhaps. Maybe background checks. I think everybody's in favor of background checks. The American public is about 75%, I think. And that may change. I don't see this as a fight that can be won by the president, because there are too many people who have to answer their constituencies in Louisiana, in Montana, in Wyoming, in a lot of other places, about half the country, and they won't be able to do it. It would pass easily in the metropolitan area, Chicago, New York, Washington, Miami, et cetera. But that isn't, that isn't the case.
Well, there are people who have aspirations to be president, such as Governor Cuomo in New York, who is out in front on this issue big time. Could this come back to bite him and others who were so forceful in their belief that we should change the laws?
Of course. Because then what would happen if he was really out front on the gun issue, say Cuomo, if he were out front on the gun issue and he started running, he'd have trouble getting support from major league Democrats like Max Baucus in Montana or John Tester in Montana or a lot of Democratic senators in gun states would have trouble supporting him. It'd be a major problem, I think.
Well, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, will be in New Orleans this Saturday for a fundraiser at the Ritz-Carlton on Canal Street with U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu. And the Republican Party Chair, Roger Villery, is calling for the Vice President to not come to New Orleans, saying he's not welcome.
What a shame in America to say the Vice President of the United States is not welcome in a city or a state. I mean, that is... There should be a new term right now. It should be called political pornography. And this man, by saying something like that, is ignoring the great institutions of America. He's ignoring the Constitution of the United States. Joe is the vice president of all of us, whether you like him or not. George Bush, who I thought was the worst president since Buchanan, was my president. I mean, constitutionally, he's my president. I mean, that's an outrage that someone would say something so silly, so shallow. So harmful. He should be ashamed of himself.
At the same
could
time,
I be stronger?
Well, go ahead.
I said, could I be stronger than that?
Well, yeah. If you keep going, you're on a roll. But at the same time, this does tie the senator to the vice president, and the president and Mary Landrieu have some political tap dancing to do. I would think this is a difficult issue for her as far as her reelection quest.
Of course it is. And all Democrats in the South have difficulty. All statewide Democrats in the South have difficulty getting elected. Mary Landrieu is one of the last of a whole group of Democrats in the Senate from the South. And she'll have difficulty. All Democrats have difficulty. She's prevailed in the last two elections, last three elections. I suspect she'll prevail again. But it will not be easy. I hope if the Republicans intend to beat her, they better come up with a very fine candidate.
Well, yesterday, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, a person you know well, testified to the House and Senate on Capitol Hill and got quite a working over, particularly from Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky. He asked about the Secretary's ill health in one breath. Then in the next, he said he would have fired her for Benghazi, calling it the worst tragedy since 9/11. Is that hyperbole, or is Senator Paul onto something?
Oh, I can't take him seriously. He's like the clown in the circus. There are certain people in Washington you can't take seriously. You just have to kind of ignore them. And people like Rand Paul, he's typical of the people that make mockery of the Senate, I think. So I didn't pay attention to him, and I don't think anyone else did either. He's not held in high esteem in the Senate. By his own colleague, so, you know, I ignored him. I expect him to say something. I expected him to be worse than that, to tell you the truth. She gave as much as she got. It was an interesting, I watched the interview. I was fascinated by the interview because I wanted to see who played what part, because you kind of predict who's going to do what. We knew what John McCain was going to do before he ever stepped up there. So, it was very interesting to just watch the players fill their roles, but none of it was unexpected.
Now, Raymond Strother, when you were working for Bill Clinton when he was running for governor several times in Arkansas and had Hillary as his top advisor, did you ever think that she would emerge as a major worldwide political phenomenon in her own right?
Never. Never. I thought she was one of the brightest people I'd ever met. She is perhaps brighter than Bill Clinton, who's an incredibly bright man. But I never thought that she would move to the up into the ranks that she has. And let me say, successfully and very well. She's a formidable candidate. One reason those senators were and House members were digging at her yesterday is they're trying to set up the next presidential race. They know if she's a candidate, it's going to be very difficult to beat her because she's even popular among Republicans.
Does she have a shot in 2016? She'll be 69 years old when the election is held. Is that that same age Reagan was, by the way, when he was elected? Is that acceptable for her with the electorate, in your judgment?
Yes. She'll be, as I say, she'll be a formidable candidate, and I think she'll be elected or could be elected. You know, a lot of things can happen. To make a prediction like that is really silly. Because, you know, she had a health problem the other day. Well, who knows? We all have health problems. She could have another one. The world could change radically. We don't know what's going to happen between now and then. But as things stand at this moment, remember, politics changes by the hour, not by the year. At this moment, she could be elected president of the United States. If she ran today, she could probably beat Barack Obama, to tell you the truth. So I won't make predictions about the future, but she's a formidable candidate.
Could her opponent be Bobby Jindal?
No.
Why?
I'd love to elaborate. No. What does he bring to the table? A very small state, which is hard to raise a lot of money. And he has sort of kind of a national following now. But there's just a lot of, and there would be some great arguments about whether or not he was an effective governor of Louisiana. I would not take him seriously personally. I think somebody else will step forth who might be a better candidate. And that's a personal opinion. I just don't see it. I just don't see it in him. I don't even understand his being governor except the strange political circumstances of the time. But that's how people are elected, strange political circumstances. But I could say in this case, I would make a prediction he will not be president of the United States.
Who on the Republican side is the supposed front runner right now?
The governor of New
Jersey. Hang on there. Do we have him back? No, I think so. I think he was talking about Chris Christie. See if we can get Raymond Strother back, Kevin. Chris Christie, of course, is the governor of New Jersey, and he is a guy who flirted with running. Remember, he came to Baton Rouge and visited with Bobby Jindal prior to announcing that he would not run in the 2012 election. And as a result, Chris Christie was on the sidelines, and he ended up being the keynoter at the Republican convention in Miami. And he did not mention Mitt Romney until well into his speech. I think we got Raymond back. You were saying Chris Christie? You're saying he's the front runner?
Yeah, Chris Christie is a candidate who appeals to both Democrats and Republicans, and he's a moderate. And the Republicans keep sliding to the right and self-destructing. If they keep sliding to the right, they're no longer going to be a factor in national elections. They haven't been a factor in the last five elections. They've only won the popular vote nationwide one time.
In the last six.
So they, unless they drop back and find somebody like Christie, who's a moderate, who's appreciated and liked by both sides, they're going to have trouble getting elected. Particularly if you had a Hillary Clinton up there, and you didn't have a moderate against her, you'd lose again.
Well, Chris Christie is a guy who is not all that popular with some people in the Republican hierarchy now, because he praised the president in the last week of the campaign for his handling of Superstorm Sandy.
Remember, the people he's not popular with, there is a small percentage of America, let's say 25% of America. We have 25% of America who are so vehemently against President Obama now. They would be against anyone. But remember, this is the same 25% who think he's not an American, the same 25% who think he's a Muslim, same 25% who's against anything he says, no matter what. So, yeah, there are a lot of Republicans who are against him, but there aren't enough of them to make a difference, as we found in this last election. They can scream and shout, and they're very loud. This Tea Party faction that's down to about 9% popularity.
Hold tight. We'll be back with Raymond Strother for a few more minutes, and also visit with Jack Refuse former White House energy advisor, back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and Jack Rafuse will be with us in just a moment, former White House energy advisor. And Raymond Strother is with us for a few more minutes. And a question from Laura downtown. She asks about your assessment of President Obama's second inaugural. How does it compare with others that you have witnessed through the years?
I think it was a brilliant inaugural. I found it interesting in a lot of respects. It was like a man being taken out of handcuffs so he could say what he wanted to. And we know this is also rare that he wrote his own speech. But when he started talking, when he compared Seneca Falls, Stonewall, and Selma, when he put those three out, that was the loudest statement I've ever heard for equal rights for all people, for blacks, for women, and for gays. And I was almost standing cheering when he got to that point. Very few people have had the courage. You know, it's the first time anyone's ever mentioned gays in a presidential speech, in an inaugural speech. It's never happened before in any way. And I don't remember anyone being that adamant about civil rights for all people. So I thought it was a beautiful speech, almost poetic. And it was sort of Obama declaring, this is really who I am, get out of my way. It was sort of a defiant speech. I liked it very much. Of course, I like in-your-face politics.
Yeah, too. Well, did it play well in places like Columbus, Georgia, and Clinton, Louisiana?
No, what you have to understand is there are places that if he says good morning, it isn't going to play well. And you can't let your presidency or your life be run by people like that, by people who are just automatically against you, no matter what you do, no matter what you say. So, no, it didn't play well in some places. But, you know, as a whole, most of America, I think it played very well. It'll never play well in Clinton. It'll never play well in most of North Louisiana or Mississippi or Alabama. It's just not going to happen.
One more inquiry, Kevin, we'll take for Raymond Strother. Lisa wants to get your take, Raymond, on the constitutional requirement that presidents not serve in office more than two terms. She notes that President Clinton was, 54 when he left office, and President Obama will be 55. A lot of living, a lot of experience between the two of them and others, but constitutionally it's all over. Is that the way it should be, or should we go back to the way it was when FDR was running for president?
I've studied both sides of it, and one thing that concerns me, and I'll begin to sound a little Republican here, I guess, is that you can consolidate too much power in 12 or 20 years or 16 years, and pretty soon the presidency becomes a center and the source of all power. And the longer you serve, the more you can consolidate your power. So I'm not sure it's a great idea, but there's a great leveling process. The voters, you know, get tired of people too. By the end of the second term, most voters are tired of the president, no matter who he is, be it Clinton or Bush or or Obama.
Maybe a solution would be to do what we do in Louisiana with governors. They can run for a third term, but they can't run for a third term consecutively.
I think that would probably be a good solution. If the Americans want somebody back, they can get them back. I find nothing wrong with that, but I really don't think there are going to be any constitutional changes anytime soon.
Well, always good to visit with you in Montana. Raymond Strother, we'll be calling soon. Take care.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for doing
Hello,
this on
Louisiana.
Short notice. There you go.
Okay,
thank you. Bye-bye. And we're joined now by Jack Rafuse. He is a former White House energy advisor and is an expert on energy issues. He's, of course, been featured in many places, including The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Times, Politico, even The Bangkok Post. Good morning to you, Jack Rafuse.
Good morning. Good morning, Jim.
Well, as far as energy policy in the United States right now, this is something that isn't getting as much attention as, say, gun rights, but it's a big part of where we are and where we're going. Where do we stand right now?
Well, I think we stand at almost the same place that we did several years ago, honestly. The biggest change during the last 4 years has been the tremendous growth in United States domestic production of oil and of natural gas. And all of that production increase really is due to the fact of shale fracking, hydraulic fracturing and directional drilling, which enables resources to be accessible that never were before. And so the United States will become the world's largest, well, it'll pass Russia within a couple of years as the largest exporter of, largest producer of oil. It will become one of the largest producers of natural gas within about the next 5 or 6 years. And according to the International Energy Agency, it could become technically self-sufficient by about 2025. So it's an astounding change in a short period of time. And the question is, will the policies advance that kind of growth or not?
Dr. Jack Rafuse is with us. 297-5633 is your number. Now, you worked for oil and gas companies through the years.
I did. Yes.
So
Unocal, as a matter of fact, right. Unocal had facilities right there in Baton Rouge. So, yes, I did.
So that experience, I would think, puts you in a pro-industry position.
It does. You're right. Yes.
Well, if you, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and I also worked while I was working for the company on a lot of regulatory issues and a lot of governmental issues. and so I think the experience all comes together, but you're right. I definitely am pro-development and pro-oil and gas.
What about cap and trade? That was the talk of Capitol Hill a few years ago. It's been waning, but is that something that would be palatable?
Well, I think I'm not sure if it would be palatable, but I think that it's back again as a major consideration, and I think people will think about it. In some ways, it's very appealing because you say it really is the government telling somebody, here's the most you can produce of pollutants, but here's a way that you can buy your way out, and then while you're buying your way out using the cap-and-trade purchased abilities to produce smog and produce pollution. At the same time, you can be working on ways to do it cheaper and cheaper. And we do know that that kind of technique can work. But I think what happened originally was the government basically was going to run everything so totally that there wouldn't have been any much ability of the companies to find cheaper ways.
Now, a few moments ago, Dr. Rafuse, you said the U.S. is on the brink of becoming the biggest energy producer, oil and gas producer in the world, and yet we hear much about this administration, the Obama administration, supposedly clamping down on the industry. How can we have both of those realities simultaneously?
Well, that's a really great point. And as a matter of fact, I mentioned that the International Energy Agency had said that within about 10 or 15 years, we would be virtually self-sufficient, but it also cautioned that that depends upon government policies. And so it's a very careful, you have to be very careful of it. Let me just mention one thing along this line. It has to do with coal. 10 years ago, coal was the fuel behind 53% of all electric generation in the United States. Now, because there's so much more gas, natural gas, being produced in this country, and because there are so many regulations already in place to drive down emissions, coal is down to 40% of the production of the fueling for electricity. So gas has taken over all of that differential. But still, the EPA wants to implement a regulation that it already has written and just held in abeyance during the campaign, and it says that it would either bankrupt or drive out of business coal companies and coal use for electric generation. Now, if the economics is working, why do you need a regulation that sounds so vindictive in the way the regulating agency is going to run things? And I'd say that the same thing is true of the way the president has for 4 years now talked about his all-of-the-above energy policy. All-of-the-above really has meant consistently tax the oil companies, tax the natural gas companies, and throw money at green companies. So, I think that you have to be really careful because the potential is there, but also the potential for negative policy is there.
Well, here in Louisiana, there are some, including a guest we had earlier this week, Foster Campbell, former state senator, public service commissioner, who wants an oil processing tax or fee. Also, former Governor Buddy Romer is calling for a similar kind of proposal right now. So what do you think about moves to tax the oil and gas companies in this state right now?
Well, again, I think that if you add a tax to something, what you have to do is to be sure that it's applied evenly. You know, it's really equity in the taxing that enables any company or any industry to say, all right, this is a stable environment. I can look ahead now and see that everybody's being taxed the same way. I think if you select one industry, then you're making it a lot harder to do that. Now, I can understand in Louisiana that people would say, well, we produce an awful lot of oil and gas, and so we ought to have an additional processing fee. And I'm just not really up to date, I'm afraid, on what the relative standing of Louisiana is in taxing on the oil and gas industry and how it might vary from place to place. But remember that North Dakota is growing really, really fast in oil and gas because they have this shale resource, for one thing, but also because of the way their taxes are working and they are attracting more and more people there. I just think you have to take a look at these things and compare them to other states and compare them to your outlook before you just say, I'm for this or I'm for that.
Mm-hmm. In Louisiana, we had a shale boom a few years ago. Now that kind of activity is going on in how many states right now?
Right now, New York has virtually ended it. Pennsylvania, it's probably in about a half dozen states. Texas, North Dakota are the two biggest ones right now. Pennsylvania has kind of slowed it down by adding some more regulations, but it's still huge in Pennsylvania. And there are several others where the outlook is very, very good for it.
How's the outlook?
The resources are huge.
And Dr. Rafuse, how is the outlook here in our state right now?
Well, again, there is shale there, and it's very good. And also, just you think about your own offshore and your own onshore development there, and the possibilities are very great. Now, most of the shale in Louisiana is up in the along the Texas border up north. And so it's not a gigantic area as it is in North Dakota, say, where the Bakken Shale probably covers about half of the state, or in New York and Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, where the Marcellus Shale covers maybe half of those states. Those are gigantic. But the shale possibilities in Louisiana up in the northwest area are very significant.
Well, as you know, the division on Capitol Hill is intense. The battle lines have been drawn between the parties. There's very little collegiality now between members of opposite parties as there once was not so long ago. Is this on display when it comes to debates regarding energy policy?
Well, it is, except it isn't quite as strictly party line because, for example, a lot of oil state and natural gas state senators and congressmen understand that if you pick out oil and gas as the one place to overtax and you throw money at other things, you're going to be hurting production in their own state, and you're going to be hurting their own job outlook and their own economy. And so those Democrats would side against the president on several of his tax aims against the oil companies.
Do you think the president acted appropriately after the Deepwater Horizon incident?
Well, I think that was just a total disaster, and there's no two ways about it. And I think if you take a look back on it and take a look at some of the things that have been written about it and the studies that have been written about it, there was a lot of bad regulatory work that went on, even though the regulations might have covered things properly. And I think when you have regulations in place that have been in place for years and are generally working, and you basically ignore them, whether you're a company or whether you're part of the regulatory team, then you're kind of asking for things. And it's a horrible case, but I'm afraid that the federal government had to step in. Now, I think when the administration stepped in on that one, basically they closed down the Gulf of Mexico production. I think that was a hideous overreaction. And then it was supposed to take a couple of months to decide what was good and what was bad, and it took 18 months before any of it was reopened. I think those things were very bad. I think that the first impulse was good, but the implementation by the administration was bad.
Well, with natural gas now being a major issue, will exports do as far as having an impact on the economy of the nation and of Louisiana?
Exports of natural gas?
Yes.
It's a very interesting thing. It's something that's just beginning to be an issue now, and it will continue to be. According to a study that was done for the DOE, Department of Energy, about a year ago, the analysis said that if exports of natural gas are permitted by the government, then it will actually increase production of natural gas in the United States, and that so the U.S. reserves will go from 25 quadrillion BTUs, British thermal units, which would be an all-time high for us, up to 27. So it would increase by 2 quadrillion BTUs of production of reserve. And now people are saying, well, you know, let me think about that. And Dow Chemical, who 2 years ago, as part of an export group that was thinking about exporting natural gas, was part of a 68-page legal document that they submitted to the DOE saying, If we export LNG, liquefied natural gas, it won't have any impact on prices.
We'll talk more with Dr. Jack Rafuse and hear from author Wiley Cash when we return. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And Dr. Rafuse, let's see if he is still there, Kevin, but we will visit with Wiley Cash in just a moment. Fascinating man who's been with us one time before, A Land More Kind Than Home. His novel has received amazing reviews. The Richmond Times-Dispatch says it reads as if Cormac McCarthy decided to rewrite Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Do we have Dr. Rafuse back? Okay. I did want to get you to elaborate briefly on the information you provided as we went to the break about how natural gas exports are not welcomed by some people like Dow Chemical. Why is that the case?
Well, Dow Chemical did welcome it a couple of years ago when they were part of an export project, and they were part of a 68-page submittal to DOE saying it won't have any price impact. Now what they're saying, along with Alcoa and other basically raw material users and fuel users who view natural gas as theirs. Now they're saying, we just want the government to be really careful about exports, and we don't want them to do it indiscriminately. And I think in this case, what indiscriminately means is we don't want any more natural gas exports because we want the cheapest prices forever, even though the DOE study and Dow's own study a couple of years ago have said there will not be a major price impact. DOE study said at most it would be 7% and probably less. So they're being self-serving, which we all are to some extent, but you ought not ignore the national interest in being self-serving either.
Well, I'm sure this will be an issue that has momentum, and we will hopefully talk with some folks, maybe Dan Bornay from the Chemical Association, who I'm sure would have at least a different point of view to express than...
Well, it's an interesting thing. The Chemical Association is not on the same wavelength as Dow and Alcoa on this, and neither a lot of other business groups. But I think you're right. I think this is an issue that's just beginning, and I think that it's well worth asking a lot of people about to get a lot of views on how it works.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ray Fuse. Appreciate your comments today. Take care.
Well, thank you, Jim. I really appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. Bye. Talk to you soon. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works as well. Wiley Cash is our guest. He is a young writer who's getting plaudits like few other young writers, and he has a Ph.D. in English from the University of Louisiana Lafayette. Good morning to you, Wiley.
Hi, good morning to you, Jim. Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, let's talk about your background in Louisiana. How did the experience at ULL influence you as a writer?
Well, I actually went down to UL to study under your buddy Ernest Gaines. I went down there in 2003 and took the last workshop he taught there before he retired. And I'm from Western North Carolina, and so as much as I love Louisiana and I consider it a second home, I got down there and realized pretty quickly that y'all don't have a lot of mountains and a lot of fresh water and a lot of seasons. I started writing about home, and this novel, Land More Kind Than Home, was a result of that.
This is your first novel, and it has gotten nice reviews, including one from National Public Radio that says the book is a thriller, beautifully written. You'll be torn about how fast to read it. This is great Gothic Southern fiction. Is that a lost art?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, there's still a lot of writers that are writing good Gothic Southern fiction. You know, Tom Franklin over in Mississippi, James Lee Burke, the Louisiana native. People are still doing it. People are still writing those Southern page turners, and I'm happy to be included amongst those ranks now. It's a really, really huge honor.
What is the focus primarily of A Land More Kind Than Home?
The central tension in the novel is the fallout in the community after a young autistic boy is smothered during a healing service in the mountains of North Carolina. And the novel investigates how different segments of the town deal with that and try to get to the bottom of the mystery of what this little boy was doing inside a church that has a newspaper over its windows.
Well, it's about the land you know well. And it is a notable book from the New York Times Book Review. So now in paperback is A Land More Kind Than Home. Why do you write about North Carolina?
I think I write about North Carolina the same reason that Ernest Gaines writes about the area around Falls River. You know, it's just in my blood. It's the place that I know the best, the landscape that I'm the most tied to. And I never wrote about North Carolina while I lived there. Just as Gaines never wrote about Louisiana while he lived there. It took a trip for him to go on out to Vallejo, California, and it took a trip of me going out to Lafayette, Louisiana, to really see my home in a way that was worthy of literature, in a way that was worthy of me looking at it in a way that would allow me to tell its story and the story of the people who are from there.
You were influenced by many, including your maternal grandfather, Harry Eugene Wiggins. What kind of a influence did he have on you, Wiley?
He was a character. He was a storyteller. He'd make up all kinds of stories. He was also really, really eccentric. he grew bananas. He somehow grew a banana tree in Gastonia, North Carolina, which is way too far north to grow banana trees that produce bananas, but he managed to do it. He had a topless mermaid bird bath that he painted to look realistic, and I'll leave your listeners to imagine what that means. And he would always also tell these outlandish stories to the grandkids that were so believable until you went and told your parents about them, and they said, oh, that's just your grandfather making stuff up. And I think that idea of making stuff up just got in my blood early on, and I haven't been able to stop.
Well, this particular novel is told from three characters' perspectives. How do you pull this off as far as keeping the story together?
Well, it was a real challenge, but there's a trick to it. I learned from books like Gathering of Old Men and As I Lay Dying and other Southern books that each character possesses his or her individual knowledge of the events. And so I had to write these characters in ways that showed and portrayed the distinct knowledge they possessed. The first narrator is a 9-year-old younger brother of the boy who suffers this tragedy. And he knows what happened inside that church. He saw through the window what they did to his brother. But none of the adults know. Only he knows. And so his narration portrays that knowledge. The second narrator is an elderly woman, the church matriarch. She knows the history of the church. She knows the power this mysterious preacher has over the congregation. The final narrator is a middle-aged sheriff who's about to retire. And he's trying to use facts to get to the bottom of this tragedy. So each character goes about their telling of events differently because they all know different things. And they're all, their ages make a difference. Their genders make a difference. So when you look at your characters as real people, they speak differently and they tell things differently. And you have to really believe in them in order to hear them.
You've crafted a fascinating character in Carson Chambliss.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. He's a real evil guy. You know, he comes into town out of nowhere, like so many of these itinerant Southern preachers do. He shows up out of nowhere, and he has evidence of his righteousness because he can handle snakes, handle fire, and drink poison, and lay hands on the sick and heal them. And the people in this community just fall for that power, and it ends up being the undoing of this church and almost the undoing of this entire community.
The book is A Land More Kind Than Home, a novel from Wiley Cash, his first, and it has been so well received, I would suspect it'll be hard to outdo yourself.
Yeah, there is that pressure a little bit of trying to write another novel after this one had some legs, so I hope I can meet the challenge.
You open with an epigraph from Thomas Wolfe. Why did you do this?
Well, Thomas Wolfe is, North Carolina's most famous literary son, and he was a huge influence on me in my years away from North Carolina. His novels are set largely in Asheville, and I would read about Asheville through his words. And so when it came time to title my novel, I wanted to pay homage to a literary influence, but I also wanted to choose a title that really resonated with the emotions in this book. And A Land More Kind Than Home hints at some kind of hope for deliverance or some kind of salvation. And that's what all the characters who suffer through this terrible tragedy are hoping for, is a better day.
Now, your story certainly doesn't shy away, Wiley, from religion. That's a topic that is, of course, sensitive, but you embrace it with zeal.
Yeah, I do, and this isn't a book that is anti-religion, but it's also not a book that's pro-religion either. This is just a book that asks people to investigate their impulses and the reasons why we do things without questioning those impulses, and especially the impulses of others. They really follow this guy Carson Chambliss blindly, and it leads them to tragedy. And at least my experience of religion in the South, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. I grew up with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Falwell. And I remember well hearing these stories of these fallen people that had millions of followers. And I know what that did to my church community. And I witnessed these own things in my church growing up in North Carolina. But this book is also about the purity of faith and the innocence of belief and the power of faith to overcome everything, and the need for forgiveness, both in the church community and in the community at large.
What did you think of Jim and Tammy Faye?
I just remember I was so young when all that happened. I can just remember my grandmother talking about sending them money, and my grandparents didn't have a lot of money to send them, and they just handed over checks like it was their job. And when this happened, even being a kid, being aware that, you know, sexual escapades were involved and money was involved, and being a kid and being 9, 10 years old and hearing adults talking about this, but also hearing adults say things like, oh, well, the devil was working on him. And even as a kid thinking, no, maybe he was just a bad guy. Maybe his heart wasn't in the right place. Don't dismiss this so easily as being an act of mankind and not an act of the supernatural.
Well, it'll be 25 years in a few weeks since Jimmy Swaggart made his infamous address to his flock, his worldwide flock, I might add, from the Family Worship Center right down the street from where we are right now, in which he said, I have sinned. And he went away for a while, not very long, came back, and now is bigger than he's ever been. It's amazing the capacity for redemption that people have.
Absolutely, and they always say the worst sinners make the best preachers.
You're probably right. Now, North Carolina has had some colorful politicians who have been engulfed in scandal, including former U.S. Senator John Edwards. Did you follow his travails with interest, Wiley?
I did, and this was while I was writing the book. And this kind of goes back to what I was saying. This isn't about evil in the church or evil in religious beliefs. The people could have been anywhere. You know, John Edwards is a guy who reached low and picked up a lot of people and got them to believe in him. And then he's now a fallen figure in North Carolina and will be forever because of those escapades. You know, if you look at the world of finance, someone like Bernie Madoff, you know, America has a long tradition of putting stock in people that we shouldn't put stock in. But at the same time, like you said, we also love forgiving people that are worthy of redemption and forgiveness, from our athletes like Michael Vick to our religious leaders. We love forgiving people who earn it, and that's what this novel is about as well, is the power of forgiveness.
Well, I see where the former governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, who ran off with his Argentinian mistress, he's now going to run for Congress again. Whoa.
Yeah, it turns out he wasn't on the Appalachian Trail like he said he was.
At least not at the time he said he was.
Not at the time, absolutely.
Now, A Land More Kind Than Home is a tale of courage in the face of cruelty, and I guess one of the overwhelming themes of the book is that the power of love overcomes the darkness that lives in us all.
Absolutely, yeah. This book is about people who are not only struggling with this recent tragedy of this young boy's death inside the church, but this is a small community, and these relationships go back generations, and there are many of these relationships are fueled by tragedy. And so in order for this contemporaneous healing to take place, these generations-old wounds have to be healed as well. And so that's really a focus of the book, almost more so than central tragedy that gets it started.
Now, Marie in Lafayette asks if you're living in West Virginia now. Is that right?
I am, yeah. My wife and I live in Morgantown, West Virginia, right about an hour south of Pittsburgh.
Yeah, the hometown of Don Knotts. But
that's true. We live actually right off Don Knotts Boulevard.
Yeah, as much as you love North Carolina, you're now living in West Virginia.
Yeah, we're trying to get back. We have dreams of getting back sooner than later. We love West Virginia, but North Carolina's home.
Yeah, well, Don Knotts influenced all of us. I remember James Carville, when he was running Bill Clinton's campaign, he had a photo of Barney Fife on his wall. He died a few years ago. I went to his gravesite a few days ago in California, and I took a photo of it, and I'm trying to find it right now, but they're very nice epitaph for Don Knotts, who won several Emmys, as Barney Fife and Andy Griffith never won an Emmy. How about that? He was a great North Carolinian. Andy Griffith was, yeah. But the book, A Land More Kind Than Home, captures Wiley's home state in all its glory, and it has gotten exceptional reviews. The New York Times Book Review says, mesmerizing, an intensely felt and beautifully told story. Thank you, Wiley.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And that'll do it for today, and we will return tomorrow, same time. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.